Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. On a cold January day in 2009, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 had just taken off from LaGuardia Airport in New York City when the plane collided with a flock of Canada geese.
The Cactus 1539 hit birds, so you've lost thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
Okay, you need to return to LaGuardia. Turn left, heading up 2-2.
Within seconds, the plane's engine started to fail.
Bird strike, he lost all engine. He lost the thrust in the engine.
Which engines?
He lost thrust in both engines, he said.
Got it.
Air traffic controllers were trying to free up a runway at a nearby airport in Teterboro, New Jersey. But the plane's pilot, Captain Chesley Sullenberger, knew he was running out of time.
Cactus 1529 over the George Washington Bridge wants to go to the airport right now.
Wants to go to our airport, check. Does he need assistance?
Yes, it was a bird strike. Can I get him in for runway one?
Runway one, that's good.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280, you can land runway one at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in Hudson.
I'm sorry, say again, Cactus.
Radio silence. And then...
210-4718. I think he said he was going in the Hudson.
Okay, he's on the Hudson River. He's just about a mile and a half north of the Lincoln Tunnel. Last sighted below 900 feet. We still got a target on him, but he looks like he's low level. You get anybody, you send him right over to the Lincoln Tunnel. We had a Cactus Airbus go down in the water.
All 155 people on board survived. The emergency landing quickly became known as the Miracle on the Hudson. It intrigued millions of people worldwide and even inspired a movie starring Tom Hanks. This is a really dramatic example of a human-animal collision. But wherever we are, wildlife is always present. Deer or rabbits that visit our yards, rats and raccoons that rummage through garbage. Living in such close proximity leads to many encounters with challenging outcomes for either species, injuries or diseases that spread from animals to humans. On today's episode, Close Contact, when humans and wild animals meet. Let's stick with the issue of bird strikes. The Miracle on the Hudson brought a lot of attention to this problem, which is very rare when it comes to large passenger planes. But it is a much bigger problem in other areas of aviation. Researchers are working to prevent birds from flying into the path of planes. Marcus Biddle has this story.
Bird strikes go back to the first days of flying. Even Orville Wright journaled about an experience hitting birds flying over an Ohio cornfield in 1905. Now, flying is considered the safest travel in the world, and since the Wright brothers' aviation breakthrough, commercial planes dominate the sky. They cruise over 30,000 feet in the air. But there are still many pilots that have to fly low. Military aircrafts, hospital medevacs, news helicopters, aerial advertising for car insurance. But few fly lower than agriculture pilots.
We hit ducks all the time. A duck is the dumbest animal there is because he won't leave the field.
Rodney Shelley is an agriculture pilot, or what's commonly known as a crop duster. For a crop duster, watering fields and spraying fertilizer requires them to fly low, just at about 12 feet off the ground. Rodney's been in this business for 29 years and has logged over 20,000 hours of agriculture aviation work. He lives in Arkansas, rice country as he often says, and it's the largest rice-producing state in the country. He's hit birds so often that he says they feel like a bump in the road.
Well, it's like driving down the highway, you know, in your pickup truck, and you hit a pothole. You don't really like it. It may startle you and scare you, but you know, you just keep on going.
Crop dusting planes fly as fast as 140 miles per hour. Hitting birds at that speed puts even the most experienced pilot in danger. Rodney's brother had a goose crash into his cockpit window while crop dusting. He almost didn't land the plane.
It knocked a hole in the windshield. I mean, knocked the whole windshield out of the aircraft. If he wouldn't have had his visor down, it would have put his eyes out. I believe it 100%.
An average day for a crop duster is long and tedious. The hours can last between the peak of dawn to the pitch black of night.
We come to work at about 4:30 in the mornings, 4:30 to 4:45, and I'm normally in the airplane by 5:15.
Rodney has his own aviation business. Farmers hire him out. He says it's expensive to maintain his fleet of two planes, and bird strikes can really make matters worse.
I've got an airplane in the shop right now that's getting exhaust stacks fixed on it from bird strikes, and I've got bird damage in my wings this year.
Arkansas is in a path known as the Mississippi Flyway, a heavy bird migration route that follows along the Missouri, Mississippi, and Ohio Valley rivers, making the state a hotspot for birds flying south for the winter. From late fall to early spring, birds like ducks and Canadian geese migrate into the area. Rodney says that the state's growing season, from early spring to fall, is often the riskiest time to fly, but also the busiest. Arkansas has a warmer climate, and rice, soybean, and corn fields need frequent watering.
Being down for a day or two with an airplane in that part of the season is detrimental. I mean, it cost the flying service a lot of money. It could cost the farmer some loss, too, because if it's a timely matter and we didn't get to it in time, you know, whatever we're treating could actually affect the crop where we should have been doing it 2 days before. Or worse than that, say the bird strike or something happens and you lose the aircraft, and then you're down to one or you're down to none. And then look, all this acreage is behind.
Federal Aviation Administration researchers have been aware of the imminent dangers bird strikes pose for non-commercial aviation pilots, and some have a personal connection to the issue.
I've hit a couple birds. You know, I've hit them during the day, I've hit them at night.
Dan Delmeyer is an electrical engineer and FAA researcher on bird mitigation in Atlantic City, New Jersey. He's flown helicopters, Boeing 727s, and general aviation aircrafts, like Cessna planes used for flight schools. He's clocked over 4,500 hours of general flight time and has had to avoid all kinds of birds, Canadian geese, ducks, turkey vultures, bald eagles, you name it.
The bigger birds are really what gets your attention because you see them come in, you're like, well, are they going to dart down? Are they going to climb on you? Do I have to duck underneath them? Do I have to turn right to avoid them?
Dan says that bird strikes involving commercial jets actually happen less than people think. And it's for one simple reason. Birds can't fly that high.
For the airline pilot, you know, that is a factor for them for takeoff and landing, but they'll get up really high. They'll get up to 30,000 feet. So, you know, birds are not up at around 30,000 feet.
Which is why many commercial airline strikes happen during takeoff, not at cruising altitude. But for helicopters and single-engine planes flying lower than 1,000 feet, it's often harder to avoid collisions with birds. Dan says that the agricultural flying industry may help solve this problem. After the miracle on the Hudson, the FAA thought of a few ideas to address bird strikes. One was creating a bird-specific radar system for the pilot. The first plan was to install a radar beacon in the cockpit that could detect any flock of birds that could come into the direct path of a plane. But the system could only detect certain birds that were much larger, like an eagle. For the FAA, it's not just about making flying safer for the pilot, but also saving the birds from death.
You want to preserve the bird population, right? You want to protect them as well because we're sharing the space with them.
So if not radar, then what? It turned out that studying a bird's eye view might have provided some answers.
Birds see not only in the normal light spectrum that we see in, but they also see in the ultraviolet light.
Humans only have one optic nerve that detects three colors, red, green, and blue. Birds, on the other hand, have two optic nerves, which allows them to see in ultraviolet light. It's called tetrachromatic color sensitivity.
And what we wanted to develop was, is there a technique or a mitigation where the pilot doesn't have to do anything? Can we build a light that has this ultraviolet capability and we pulse it where the birds will see this pulsing light? So it's like a beacon to say, oh, wait, there's something there. Let me divert away.
But testing this idea required flying through a flock of birds, which was very risky.
I didn't know if we were going to crash the aircraft into some birds or how it was going to work.
That's Donald Ronning, a chemist and owner of Light Enterprises in Maine. He is one of the lead researchers on this project and developed the ultraviolet bulb that would be used for the test run. It's a bulb that's only 6 inches in diameter and uses multiple LED colors of ultraviolet light.
We mounted the landing light on the aircraft. We flew half the flights with the lights on and the other half with just white lights. And we flew it into flocks of mostly ducks and Canada geese. And we picked the time of the year where the migration pattern was very heavy.
Donald had never seen so many birds in the air, and especially so close to a plane taking off to fly.
One of the very first days, there literally was probably tens of thousands of birds. The sky was completely filled with birds landing and taking off from the different rice fields and soybean fields.
The results were seen almost instantly, what Donald described as a parting of the Red Sea moment.
We immediately saw that the birds in the airspace in front of the aircraft avoided the airplane dramatically, and they flew around it. We saw flights pass of flocks of birds that would literally do dramatic avoidance behaviors to get out of the light.
And if you're wondering who flew the plane for these test runs, it was agriculture pilot Rodney Shelley.
Do you remember me telling you how dumb a duck was? I could enter the field, the ducks would get up and they would move 2 to 3 miles away. They would not stay in the field with me. If they see the light, they do not like it. They get away from it. They'll turn and go the opposite way.
Rodney often says the only way to keep from hitting a goose is slowing the plane down or speeding the goose up. Ultraviolet lights won't fix the problem 100%, but it's a step in the right direction.
This is going to eliminate the majority of the bird strikes.
And it could be a potential game changer for the future of aviation safety.
I see these lights working wonders.
That story was reported by Marcus Biddle. We're talking about close contact between humans and wildlife. Coming up, being near animals means that illnesses and viruses can travel from them to us. We'll take a look at efforts to keep a deadly disease contained.
It's nice to think that you could just step back and let nature take its course. But we're really managing wildlife in human-altered systems.
That's still to come on The Pulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. One of the things pet owners have to take care of is getting their dogs or cats vaccinated against rabies. It's a deadly but preventable disease. Being exposed or even potentially being exposed can set off a really involved chain of events. Denise Martel learned that the hard way. More than 20 years ago, she was a nursing student in Concord, New Hampshire. She already had a cat at home and she wanted to adopt a kitten. So she went to a local pet store where she was greeted by a bunch of cute kittens running around. She adopted a black and white kitten she called Lucy.
At first, she was a typical kitten, playful. And unfortunately, when she became ill, she was very docile and quiet and just kind of laid around a little bit.
Denise took Lucy to the vet where the kitten got some antibiotics and then went back home.
We woke up in the middle of the night and she was seizing and eventually just died on her bed. So we called the vet, pretty hysterical at that point.
It turned out Lucy had rabies. Denise and her boyfriend had to get the post-exposure treatment for rabies, which involves multiple very expensive injections. Her mother had also adopted one of the kittens, so did a friend, and lots more people in the town had visited the pet store and played with them.
I was all over the news. Our local paper at the end of the year called it the Year of the Kitten.
More than 600 people got treated for rabies, and it all cost more than $1 million.
You never heard of anybody really getting exposed, especially in the way I was from a kitten I got at a pet store. It was just unheard of, and even today, I'm still a little flabbergasted that it actually did happen to me.
The CDC investigated this case and found that some of the kittens at the pet store had been feral and may have gotten rabies from a raccoon. Raccoons are the second biggest carrier of rabies in the wild, second to bats. Raccoons rarely bite humans, but they will bite feral cats and dogs. Rabies in raccoons has been a problem for decades on the east coast of the U.S. And then some scientists had an unusual idea. What if they vaccinated raccoons? Alan Yu has more.
If you wanted to vaccinate raccoons with a shot, first you would have to trap them and then inject them. That's not really feasible given there are so many raccoons. So instead, every year, scientists and staff at the U.S. Department of Agriculture fly over states on the East Coast to airdrop oral rabies vaccines hidden inside tasty bait packs. Raccoons really like the smell of fish, so the vaccine is put inside a bait that looks, and more importantly, smells like a waxy, fishy dog biscuit.
The plane will smell like fish for days. Our folks will smell like fish as they exit the aircraft until they can do some laundry.
One day in early October, biologist Jordana Kirby and her team at the USDA load hundreds of thousands of the vaccine bait packs out of a refrigerated trailer and onto small planes. The planes start from a small airport in Southwest Virginia to airdrop vaccines to parts of Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. The bait packs roll out of the planes on conveyor belts that look like treadmills.
And they'll actually go out the bottom of the aircraft through the funnel down a tube, and there's a hole at the bottom of the tube in the aircraft. And
so a navigator will tell a pilot when the plane is over a house, a lake, or someplace where they do not want the bait packs to go. The origins of this program go back to the early 1990s. Charles Ruprecht teaches at Auburn University in Alabama now. But back then, he had just joined the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to run their rabies program. He says people knew to vaccinate their own pets. They knew to keep a safe distance when admiring wildlife so nobody gets bitten. But they did not know what to do about raccoons. Raccoons are highly adaptable mammals that are comfortable living in the wild, but equally comfortable in the gray area between the quote-unquote wilderness and our human environments.
So it was a bit of a public health conundrum on what to do about raccoon rabies.
He says when a human may have been exposed to rabies, they need to get two things: antibodies that have to be grown in a lab and a vaccine. In 1993, the reported cases of animal rabies in the U.S. reached a record high, partly because of rabid raccoons on the East Coast. The U.S. did not have anywhere near enough vaccine doses, and manufacturers could not make the antibodies grow faster in their labs. The CDC had to figure out some way to not burn through the existing supplies, and this is what they came up with.
Clinicians would be given a password from the state health departments before they could order biologics demonstrating that they had gone through a risk assessment.
The idea was that only people who had actually been exposed to rabies would get the treatment. Vets, veterinary technicians, people going to travel, these people would normally get rabies vaccines as a preventative measure, but they could not get the rabies vaccine at the time.
I mean, can you imagine today a physician who wants to order a critical biologic and can't get it unless he gets a state health department password?
A more long-term strategy was to reduce the transmission of rabies among wild animals. Scientists had recently tested oral rabies vaccines for foxes and raccoons, which animals could get just by eating bait that contains the vaccine. But US scientists had never used vaccines on wildlife on a large scale before.
From the standpoint of the wildlife biologist, oftentimes this was a brand new way of thinking about it.
Charles says public health officials were worried about this approach, especially after a case in the late 1970s when a scientist working on a rabies vaccine for foxes got rabies from the lab work.
People only remember that major adverse event, and now to convince them that there was no way that rabies could be produced from this new way of making a vaccine and that the adverse events were much different. You know, people wanted a zero risk scenario.
By the 1990s, the manufacturing process for the vaccine had changed, but Charles says the memory of that case still loomed over the discussions. Scientists from state and federal agencies got into heated debates about doing an oral rabies vaccination campaign. Rich Chipman is a biologist working on rabies at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He remembers those discussions.
There was a lot of debate as to whether the use of oral vaccine is somehow unnatural and perhaps using a vaccine as wildlife medicine and not letting natural processes take place.
It's one thing to vaccinate pets, farm animals, or animals that humans directly take care of. But should wildlife management reach beyond that to give medicine to wild animals? Rich says people ultimately came around to the idea.
It's nice to think that you could just step back and let nature take its course. But we're really managing wildlife in human-altered systems. There's nothing quote-unquote natural in most areas in the world at this point. There's some impact that humans have, whether it's airplanes flying over a wilderness area or it's an ATV in somebody's backyard or putting roads through the woods.
Eventually, the scientific groundwork and discussions led to the multi-state effort to vaccinate raccoons on the East Coast against rabies. That started in the 90s and continues to this day. USDA biologist and field coordinator Jordana Kirby started working on this program in 2005.
Prior to that time, I had all of these grand visions. I was, you know, going to be a carnivore biologist working with mountain lions and, you know, out in the field and trekking through the woods all the time.
But her first job was working on raccoon rabies in Kentucky. Later, she took her first plane trip to airdrop rabies vaccine bait over the mountains of West Virginia as part of the ORV, or Oral Rabies Vaccination Program. She spends weeks on the road every year. Fortunately, her family knows firsthand how much fun this work can be.
My husband and I got married in August of 2005, and we literally drove from our honeymoon to our first ever ORV bait drop. He's also a wildlife biologist and at the time was also getting involved with rabies management. And so we hopped on our first plane and we flew together. And when you're in an ORV plane, you're flying at a pretty low altitude and it's pretty bumpy and the baits are highly attractive and they sort of stink. So there's a possibility of getting airsick. And I unfortunately was in that boat. So we're taking our first ORV baiting assignment and I'm getting airsick and my husband, my brand new husband, is having the time of his life. And so to this day, he still calls it an extension of our honeymoon and I sort of beg to differ.
But now Jordana loves being in the field for months at a time in the summer and fall to airdrop vaccines, coordinating with all the state and federal partners and following the latest research to keep this deadly disease in check. Scientists supporting the program say the vaccines are keeping raccoon rabies under control, confined to the East Coast and out of the Midwest. The goal is to have more and more vaccinated raccoons to stop the spread of the virus. They estimate this work saves millions of dollars a year in terms of rabies shots that humans do not need. Biologist Rich Chipman and the team calculated the rate at which they have been shrinking the areas where there are raccoons with rabies. They have a goal of eliminating raccoon rabies from the East Coast by 2063.
I'll be 103 years old at the time, and I hope I'm still standing and still cheering everybody on. If not, I'll know that I went maybe earlier than I wanted to, but I got to see the progress that we really are making.
That story was reported by Alan Yu with help from audio producer Ethan Hunt. Diseases that are transmitted from animals to humans have gotten more attention in the wake of COVID-19. Earlier this year, I interviewed science writer Ed Yong at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, and he mentioned that the speed in which viruses and diseases spread from one animal to the next and then to humans could be accelerating because of climate change.
As the climate warms, animals are being forced to relocate to track their preferred environmental conditions. And that means that species are changing their ranges all the time. And that means that animal species that never previously coexisted will suddenly find themselves living in the same place because they will have moved. And that will give opportunities for their viruses, which were unique and special to them, to jump into new hosts and then eventually into us. There was a very good paper that came out this year showing exactly this process, that it is well underway and that we are living through probably like the golden age of that process, of what I have termed the pandemocene in my reporting. And the horrible thing about that is that a lot of the spillovers will be concentrated in areas with high human habitation, and that process is now effectively runaway. Like, even if we halted all greenhouse gas emissions today, the momentum of climate change will mean that that increased spillover dynamic will continue happening.
That science writer Ed Yong, I interviewed him about his book, An Immense World, at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. We're going to post the whole interview as a podcast extra, so be sure to look out for that and to follow our podcast. One of the diseases that is spread from animals to humans is called Chagas. It's caused by a parasite transmitted by kissing bugs. Now, kissing bugs are probably lesser-known blood-sucking insects in this country, but they are predominant in many parts of Latin America, and their reach may be spreading. Sam Schramsky reports from New Mexico.
Emily Pollum is a biologist fascinated by living things. And it shows as she gives me a tour around her property in rural southwestern New Mexico. She points out the little details about the local flora and fauna, lost on most of us, before she starts to clean up a midden, a nest built by wood rats.
They're relentless, these pack rats are, and they love pallets.
These rodents, about the size of a city rat, live all over the Southwest. Their handiwork, the middens, are piles of debris you might find under your car hood. And yes, they can get in there. Or in your backyard, or in Emily's case, under wooden pallets near her front door. But Emily isn't really concerned about the messy nest. What she's worried about is kissing bugs. They ravenously feed off of these pack rats and reproduce ever more offspring shortly afterwards.
And I'm not initially seeing any kissing bugs right now, but it is pretty cold out.
Kissing, cone nose, or vampire bugs, triadamines to be scientific, are a group of 130 different species of insects. If you live in the Southwest or the South, you're probably familiar with them. They look like beetles with long snouts, and they're bloodsuckers. But unlike mosquitoes or ticks or even biting flies, you usually don't even know if you've been bitten by them unless you're allergic to their saliva. Their bite is itself painless. The problem with these kissing bugs is that they can carry a parasite known as Trypanosoma cruzi, T. cruzi for short, which can cause Chagas disease.
It's very, very tricky parasite. It's very complex parasite.
That's Rosa Maldonado, professor of microbiology at the University of Texas, El Paso.
Trypanosoma cruzi is a parasite. You can live with this disease 10, 20, 30 years before you know that you are sick.
Chagas, the disease Rosa is referring to, can lead to heart failure, damage to the esophagus and gastrointestinal tract, even death in about 20 to 30% of those who contract it. A few years ago, the World Health Organization estimated that between 8 to 10 million people worldwide suffer from Chagas, mostly in Latin America, and particularly in Bolivia and elsewhere in South America. Here in the U.S., estimates have the numbers as high as 300,000 people being infected with the T. cruzi parasite, although most experts believe that the majority of these cases were contracted abroad, outside of the U.S. That said, all of these human infections came from blood-sucking kissing bugs.
Kissing bug is not a very efficient vector of Chagas disease. They have to feed on you, they have to defecate.
Jane Pierce is an entomologist at New Mexico State University who studies kissing bugs. She says the parasite passes through the insect's fecal matter, its poop, before then entering its human host through a bite. In Latin America, food and drink contaminated with the bug's feces is a major mode of transmission as well.
Which means you scratch on the wound, or it means you go into your nostril, you rub your eye, you put it in your mouth. It's not efficient at all. It's really a lousy vector. It's just a lousy vector, it really is.
The estimated number of locally acquired Chagas cases in people in the U.S. is low, likely 10,000 or less, although all such estimates are very rough. But the disease is passing on to other warm-blooded creatures here, as Jane points out.
And dogs are at quite high risk.
Recent studies of dogs in Texas are sobering. In big kennels with several dogs, up to half of the pooches have been found to carry the parasite. This doesn't mean that all of these dogs have Chagas disease by any means, but many do. And scientists are increasingly documenting cases where dogs die from the disease after becoming infected. Last month, I visited microbiologist Rosa Maldonado in her lab at the University of Texas, El Paso. There, she's monitoring the prevalence of T. cruzi in kissing bugs and other animals. I also visited some of the sites in Texas and New Mexico where she collected blood samples. I'm here in rural Anthony, New Mexico, right on the border of New Mexico and Texas. Here in other places, Dr. Maldonado and her colleagues collected kissing bugs and blood samples from animals and found that most of the bugs were infected with the parasite T. cruzi. They also identified blood samples from those T. cruzi positive bugs and found that indeed pack rats, dogs, and yes, humans had been fed upon at some point in their life cycle. To be clear, it's not that Chagas disease is the next major epidemic in the U.S., certainly not on the order of COVID-19. But researchers also don't really know the magnitude of the threat. There's also very little understanding of just how many people who have immigrated from parts of Latin America, where Chagas is prevalent, are living with the disease and just aren't being screened.
And so I feel like oftentimes the people that are mostly exposed or mostly affected are coming from places where they don't have access to medical care.
That's Paula Granado-Stigler, an associate professor of environmental health at San Diego State University and longtime Chagas researcher.
Probably not going to get screened or diagnosed. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of missed diagnoses, or it's very underdiagnosed disease here in the United States. And the disease is a bit complicated in that you can be infected with the disease or the parasite, have no symptoms, and live your entire life completely symptom-free.
The disease is indeed complicated. Not everyone who carries the parasite contracts Chagas disease, and not everyone who has Chagas will have the most troubling symptoms like heart failure. But 60 to 70% of people may be in an indeterminate phase where they don't develop severe symptoms right away. It could take 20 to 25 years for this to happen. After this latent period, the damage has been done, as in potentially the need for a heart transplant or having to live with a severely damaged colon, and of course, the possibility of death.
At that point, if you're presenting with the disease and symptoms, it's a little too late for treatment potentially. So do we have the resources to screen everybody? No. Is it so prevalent that we should be screening everybody? No. But definitely targeting places where we think there's a higher risk, yes.
It speaks to the social determinants of health that your race, ethnicity, class, gender identity, or immigration status may determine the type of health outcome you receive. Because the burden of disease is overwhelmingly felt by Latino and low-income populations, many public health experts aren't so concerned about massive new transmission in the U.S. Rather, they often seem as much concerned about the people who could already have the disease, including mothers who may pass T. cruzi on to their children congenitally. And it's not only that monitoring and testing for Chagas are rudimentary compared to much better-known diseases in the U.S. It's also that the drugs used to treat acute Chagas come with serious side effects. Some states, like my native New Mexico, don't even list Chagas as a reportable disease. And all of this often assumes a patient has access to the healthcare system, a bit of a stretch for many living in poverty or immigrants who are undocumented.
We have a policy of containment.
Desi Hernandez is an English professor and author of the nonfiction book, The Kissing Bug, which explores how underserved populations fall through the cracks when they have a disease like Chagas.
And once a disease is contained to a marginalized or vulnerable group, we are pretty satisfied as a whole, publicly.
We may never know for sure how big a threat Chagas is for hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S., even if we very well do know how big it is in Latin America. But kissing bugs that crawl among us here are vectors for the parasite, as animals like dogs and pack rats make very clear. We also know that kissing bug bites can cause serious allergic reactions, up to anaphylaxis, which alone is a reason to control their infestations around our homes. Emily Pollum, the biologist who is always scanning her property in rural New Mexico for kissing bugs, knows this all too well. Her partner, John Gorey, himself a biologist, is a perfect example.
I didn't know what was going to happen with me after the bite because I was feeling really hot. I was starting to actually get hives and my entire body started to itch. And I didn't have any breathing difficulties, but it seemed like that was the next step.
And Emily and John are working to increase awareness of kissing bugs.
The way that I feel about the risk of Chagas in my own life with the kissing bugs that are around my own home is that it's important for me to be aware and develop measures for being cautious, but I don't feel afraid all of the time. Fear that we have is much more having to do with the allergy than from the risk of Chagas.
And a whole host of hardworking scientists, doctors, activists, and even writers are doing the same about the larger threat of Chagas. It could well be through their efforts that many will have less fear of a painless nibble in the middle of the night.
That story was reported by Sam Shramsky.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're always surrounded by wild animals, sharing space with them, and our close proximity can be detrimental for those creatures. Animals that live in the wild are often injured or killed by human activities, especially driving, and some of these injured animals need help to get better. Nicole Curry met up with some very dedicated volunteers who rescue these creatures and nurse them back to health.
It was a Sunday afternoon. Connie Campanella was standing in her kitchen when her phone buzzed.
The text came, and it said there's a mission.
She looked at the message, grabbed her code, and quickly typed a one-word reply, claim. Her husband was in the next room.
He was on his Peloton, and I just ran into the bedroom and said, bald eagle, put my shoes on and left. He knew it. Nothing else needed to be said.
This sudden and somewhat dramatic type of exit happens with Connie a lot, but her husband totally gets it.
It's 100% understanding, and I think he's proud of me.
Connie was on her way to rescue an injured bald eagle found on a nearby farm. The eagle was unable to fly high enough to get back to its nest. Every time it tried, it would crash and hit a tree. Connie was the person to call for this job because she volunteers for Wildlife in Need. It's an organization that rescues injured wildlife in Pennsylvania. She got involved with the group about 2 years ago after hearing about their work from a neighbor. She completed training and received her wildlife capture and transport permit. Part of the job is to be ready to go anytime help is needed.
So I can get a call at 8 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock at night. And yes, sometimes just before dinner is about to be served. But what's more of a priority? You know, so dinner gets delayed a couple of hours. Big deal.
The hours aren't an issue for Connie. She's a 67-year-old retired government consultant with a lot of time on her hands.
You've got an animal that's suffering, that may be in pain. It may be in danger of being more hurt by staying where it is. For example, on the side of a road. If it's there on the side of the road, it's possible that it's going to get hit again, or some other creature is going to come along.
After Connie got the text about the bald eagle, she met up with the two farmers who had reported the injured bird.
And they were given advice about putting a box over it.
That's what wildlife experts usually recommend.
In order to calm them down. Because if they see you, you are a predator. They're stressed. They're frightened.
But the box trick didn't work out in this case.
It still had enough strength that it blew the box off and flew, crashed into some trees, and then came back to the ground. So they went the extra mile and got a bucket, a heavy metal bucket, and then put a brick on top of it to make sure, leaving enough air, of course. But I couldn't put the bucket in my carrier.
Connie went to her vehicle, where she keeps a lot of her equipment. Most of her stuff is hand-me-downs, items that a neighbor or friend thought she could use. She has nets and travel crates, often used for dogs, and recently she acquired a metal cage trap to rescue a fox. But for this job, Connie took out a dark and heavy blanket.
I put it over the bucket and then very, very slowly and carefully worked him to the blanket and the bucket out from over him. It you know, took a little while. Do it carefully. We were still dealing with a strong bird. And he has talons. He has very, very, very serious weapons. And it's just literally a process of transferring the animal from where we found it to the carrier.
Connie drove to the nearest rehabilitation center and dropped the eagle off. Her part of the job was done. The eagle recovered and was released a few months later. From afar, Connie may look like a superhero, a standout citizen. But some critics push back on this narrative and say that people should actually just let nature take its course. Leave an animal in its habitat if it appears hurt or sick. But people who rescue and rehabilitate injured wildlife argue that our human impact on nature has become so outsized, so grave, that this look the other way notion doesn't really hold up anymore. More than a million animals are killed each day by vehicle collisions in the U.S., and volunteers like Connie see the fallout of that and other human activities firsthand.
I caught a trumpeter swan that had injured itself getting fishing line off its bill. I had a goose that had fishing line so wrapped around one leg it had become embedded, rendering it lame. We have people shoot animals and leave them to die, but they don't. They're just walking around injured.
We're not going to change the way people live. Technology and progress just rolls on. But I think we can make small, impactful changes that will help animals.
That's Michelle Wellard. She's the Associate Director of Philadelphia Metro Wildlife. It's a wildlife rehabilitation center in Norristown, Pennsylvania. They've been in operation since 2018.
Based on what they look like the white one.
I went to visit Michelle at her center a few months ago.
We're putting the animal back into the state it was before the actions of humanity injured the animal or, you know, harmed it in some way.
Volunteers like Connie transport injured wildlife to centers like this. Just last year, they treated more than 3,000 animals. During my tour, I spotted a red-shouldered hawk, a herring gull, and even a very talkative duck.
We have 3 chickens and a little duck, and he thinks he's a chicken. He hangs out with the chickens.
Michelle told me that someone had kept this duck as a pet and abandoned it. It now lives at the center.
No, you don't want to be pet today?
The center mainly works with wild animals. Michelle says that they see a variety of injuries, and although it's often unclear how an animal was hurt, there are clues.
Right now, this is another hurt pigeon recovering from an injured wing. We think he got hit by a car as well. He was found in the street, like on the street, being unable to fly. So the clues suggest he was hit by a car. He could have hit a building, too.
Michelle says they receive a lot of birds that crash into buildings during migration season.
Some of these are deep woodland birds who have never seen a city before. So not only are they hurt, they're completely disoriented. They don't know what's going on.
The animals are here to recuperate. The center keeps a volunteer veterinarian on staff to perform invasive procedures like surgeries. And rehabilitators like Michelle nurse animals back to health, bottle feeding infant mammals, administering shots, and hiding medication and food. If you think about it, it's all very similar to how you would care for a sick pet. This kind of work takes time, dedication, and money. Small grants, donations from the local community, and the volunteers themselves fund the rehabilitation center. And because of that, they often have to pick and choose which equipment or medicine to purchase if funds are low. And sometimes it can feel like rolling a boulder up a hill.
More animals are killed in one night on Pennsylvania highways than we take care of all year. So we are not making a difference to population.
For the animals whose lives they do save, Michelle and her team work hard to prepare them for release. For example, volunteers teach young owls how to hunt prey as they would in the wild. Squirrels are often released in the summer so they would have time to store food for the winter. And these animals are often released in the exact spot where they were found, like a crow Michelle showed me.
Oh, wow. He's been here for a long time, and he was really sick. And we presumed that he had West Nile virus because he was negative for everything else based on the symptoms he was showing. And he's really been improving. He looks a lot better. He put on weight. He's not showing neurological symptoms anymore. And we're really happy to release him. He is also one that must go back where he came from because crows are very, very social and family oriented. They live in little family groups that he needs to go back to his family. They're probably going to be like, where have you been? We had a funeral and everything, but they'll be surprised to see him.
When it's time to part ways for good, it's an emotional moment for Michelle.
I still do worry about them as if like they're my children or something, you know. I still think, are you going to be okay out there? And I'm sure they will. But that's a little worrying. But when it's an animal who was hurt and we let it go, that's really the best feeling. It's like job well done, and now you can continue to live your life.
But Michelle admits that these emotions are more than likely one-sided.
You know, they're not thankful. I think they'd give us the finger if they could, you know, on the way out. All those times we've grabbed them, stuck needles in them, you know, put an anesthesia mask over their face. They have no idea what we're doing to them. So they're angry, they're irritated. So we don't get any thanks from our patients.
That story was reported by Nicole Curry. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Grant Hill. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.